We're learning this week about Sfnim Meshuras HaDin, the idea that Chashan Mishpat has all its rules and regulations, which are binding, but then beyond that, there is the notion of Sfnim Meshuras HaDin, going beyond the letter of the law, the spirit of the law, doing God's will in Chashan Mishpat. So we discussed briefly Monday that there's a major machlokas, Rishonim and Achronim, whether you can compel people to act Sfnim Meshuras HaDin or not, and we also said that basically the two main parameters of deciding when to invoke Sfnim Meshuras HaDin that the post can discuss. One of them is the wealth of the person we're asking to, the financial resources. We're more likely to ask a rich person than a poor person, both, I think, inherently, objectively, how much money does he have, as well as vis-a-vis the other guy. If we're asking you to return an aveda that you don't have to return to the loser, so if you're rich and he's poor, we'll be more likely to ask you to do that. If you're poor and he's rich, we're less likely. If you're both rich or both poor, then it's more of a judgment call. The other issue they talk about is the spiritual level of the person. A person who's at a higher madrego, the Talmud Chacham, or Tzaddik, or generally more pious and more stringent, we will have a greater expectation. You know, as my father always says, you know, no good deed goes unpunished. If you have this higher level of conduct in general, we'll expect more from you going forward. We mentioned one of the key Gemaras that all the posts can talk about is the Gemara in the end of HaPoalim. The Gemara has an anecdote there where one of the Amoraim hired workers to carry his wine for him, barrels of wine. They were negligent. They broke the wine. He wanted to confiscate their garments. So he was surprised. And the Dayan said, no, give them back. Don't charge them for the wine. Give them back their garments. He said, Dina Hachi, is that the din? So he said, in. He said, yes, because the Pasuk says, Pasuk in Mishle, Laman Telech Bederach Tovim, which means Rashi's Lufim Meshur Sadin. Other posts can maybe a little bit differently, but basically Lufim Meshur Sadin. Then they said, you know, we're poor. Good. We're not losing our shirts off our backs, literally, but we're poor. We counted on our wages all day to put food on the table, and now he's not paying us. The Dayan said, pay him, pay them. So he said, Dina Hachi, is that the din? They broke my barrels and I should pay them. He said, yes, and quoted the end of the same Pasuk in Mishle, V'archa Sadikim Tishmar, should heed the ways of the righteous. So I want to discuss tonight a little bit how various Achronim have approached this Gemara, what exactly it means. So many Achronim start with the same question. They say, he asked him, the person who was being held chayiv and basin said, Dina Hachi, is that the din? He didn't say, no, it's not the din, but it's Lufnim Meshuras HaDin, so do it anyway. That's not what he said. He said, in. He said, yes, that is the din. And then he brought a pasuk that was Lufnim Meshuras HaDin. So which is it? Is it din, or is it not, or is it Lufnim Meshuras HaDin? So many Achronim, the Bina Leitim of Rabbi Azariah Figo, the Atzei Broshim of Rav Shlomo HaKohen of Vilna, as well as the Heshev Moshe, or Moshe Teitelbaum, all have pretty much the same approach. They all say that Lufnim Meshuras HaDin can become din under the appropriate circumstances. They all basically say that the idea was, since Rabbi Bar Barchanan, the protagonist of the story, the one who hired the workers, since he was a great tzaddik, someone who was typically machmer, typically conducted himself in money matters in particular perhaps, held himself to a high standard, therefore for him, this was din. For an ordinary person, it's generally what we call a Lufnim Meshuras HaDin. But for a person on a high spiritual madrega, it actually becomes din. So we told him, in, this is din. For you, it's din. For people on your, it wouldn't be din for everyone. It wouldn't be din for ordinary people, but for you, it's din. Now the Gaon, in his work, Evan Shlema, learns a little bit differently. I don't understand, his comment is, as is characteristic for him, fairly terse. I don't understand exactly how he reads this into the Gemara. The Gaon seems to understand that there are actually two levels. In the Gemara has the same Shakavataria, the same dialogue twice. First, about whether he can actually charge them for the damage, and he wanted to charge them, and the Dayan said no. Then they have the same discussion about the payment. Again, he said, I don't want to pay them. The Dayan said yes. The Gaon seems to understand that the first part, the idea of not charging them, that's something we expect even of ordinary people. That's basically what the Meshuras HaDin. Even ordinary people should cut them a break and not charge them for damages, even though they were negligent. The second part of actually paying them, that's a much higher madrega. That's something we only expect of people on a very high madrega. I don't know where the Gaon saw this in the Gemara. I mean, obviously, you see that to some extent, both common sense tells us that the second stage was more of a higher level of piety than the first. And the Gemara itself, the mere fact, I guess, that even after he went through the first discussion, he still had to go through the second discussion, implies that one doesn't follow logically from the other. But how exactly the Gon saw that the first Gemara of In Laman Telch B'Derech Tovim is something he would have said for everyone, and the second Gemara is only something he said for him, I don't really understand. The other Achronim pretty much assumed that even the first Gemara, there's a distinction between tzaddikim and ordinary people, and that he was telling him, Laman Telch B'Derech Tovim, for you, you're a tzaddik, you are mechuyev to go, for you, this is din, to go in the way of the Tovim. For ordinary people, it would just be an aspiration. Try to be like the Tovim. Shlomo Melech said, the Tovim do this for them, it's a chiyuv. You're not on that madrega, you're an ordinary person, we're ordinary people. For us, we strive to do things above and beyond. We grow, we do things that are beyond the madrega that we're on. The other poskim seem to learn that even the first part of the Gemara, they might also agree that there are still two levels, but they seem to hold even the first level of the Gemara is something that's only din for special people, and it's not din for ordinary people. But the Gon makes this distinction between the two parts of the Gemara. Rav Moshe Feinstein also seems to distinguish the two. Rav Moshe has a very interesting approach to the Gemara. Rav Moshe is in a tshuva that we actually saw, or at least touched on earlier, several months ago, when we were learning Anim Hapeh B'Charara. Rav Moshe is arguing that whenever he's starting from the other Gemara in Anim Hapeh, where the Dayan told him he took the field by mistake, he didn't realize the other guy was looking for it, and the Dayan told him, give it back. So Moshe learns anytime in a Gemara a Dayan tells somebody do something, that's din. You know, a Dayan doesn't tell you l'chem mishur is din, or he marks it as such. If he's telling you it's l'chem mishur is din, he should tell you it's l'chem mishur is din. Moshe takes for granted that anytime someone orders somebody else in the Gemara to do something, that's din. What about this Gemara of the barrels? He told him do it. He told him dinahach. He said in. That's clearly only l'chem mishur is din. So how do you square that? So Moshe understands that this was a form of tzedakah. That tzedakah is something Beis Din can actually force you to do. Now, it wasn't necessarily out-of-pocket tzedakah, because for someone to actually take money out of his wallet and give it to the ani, that's something, you have to do that too, but that's something the whole community has to do. We can dump on one person and say, you do it, you do it. So Rav Moshe understands that when the Dayan told him, L'man Telch B'Derech Tovim, he was telling him, it's sort of tzedakah, I wouldn't tell you to take money out of your pocket, but the Derech Tovim, what Tovim do, is they don't charge other people who are poor and are barely making ends meet as it is, who are living hand to mouth. What Tovim do is they don't charge such people, even if those people committed a tort against them and should be chayav al pidin. That's not the way of good people, of righteous people, to charge them. So it's sort of a form of tzedakah, and but it's more than what the Mishur Sadin, because he wasn't telling him to actually pay money out of his pocket. He was just telling him to be mochel the money and not charge him. Rav Moshe also explains the two steps in the Gemara. Rav Moshe says that when Rabbi Bar Bar Chanan heard the first instruction, don't charge them, he thought what that meant was, put it on hold. Don't write off the debt, but just leave them alone. Don't press them for it. But the chov still exists. As long as the chov still exists, I'm not going to pay them their salary because they still have an outstanding debt to me. I'm not going to charge them. Since they owe me the money, I'm not going to pay them the salary. Rav, the Dayan, then told him, no, what I mean is, that since they're poor and there's no foreseeable future in which they're going to be rich, you should write off the debt totally. You should just eliminate the debt. Once you write it off, then you owe them the salary too. I don't really understand that, because even if he writes it off, he should write it off minus the salary. He shouldn't write it off to the extent that he owes them salary. It should be nice enough that I'm willing to write off anything that you owe me above what I owe you, but not to erase the salary, not to mechayev myself salary. That's how Rav Moshe understands. Those were the two steps in the Gemara. First, he told him, don't collect the debt, which means the debt is still there, therefore I'm not going to pay salary. But he told him, no, write off the debt entirely, and that's a sort of din of tzedakah, and I mainly owe them the salary too. But Rav Moshe says, in general, to actually force somebody to pay money out of pocket is not something that a dayan would tell somebody to do. I'm not sure how Rav Moshe deals with the whole sugya that we discussed on Monday, the whole sugya of many poskim say that we are kofen l'chem mishur sadin, even something which is pure l'chem mishur sadin, actually paying money out of pocket, we are still kofa sometimes. Rav Moshe seems to be assuming that we're not kofa l'chem mishur sadin, that we're never kofa, that we can never say din, we can never tell you to do something. It was only in this case where it was sort of a form of tzedakah, and it was only a question of writing off a debt, not of paying out of pocket. That's how Rav Moshe understands this Gemara. Now, one very interesting thing I once came across in this discussion moving away from, also really connected to this Gemara.
Is it possible that there's like a chiluk between the actual property that was damaged and the actual labor that they did, and they're almost on two separate tracks, as it were?
So this is something that comes up in based in the lab. This is something that comes up very often. If someone works for you and he also commits some injury against you, damages the property he's working on, for example, do we look at those as two separate claims that each have to be adjudicated separately, or do we look at that as one general claim that if you've damaged my property, then you haven't fixed it. On the contrary, you've damaged it. You look at the net result, and therefore I'm not going to pay you. So it's a very important question. It comes up sometimes, especially when there are questions of sfeikas, you know, with one or both of the claims not absolutely certain. So do you say, let the judge each case separately on the merits and make you pay for this one and that one is a suffix? Or do we say, at the end of the day, roll them all together, and if there isn't absolute certainty, we say, muksik matzmer al haraya. We once had a case in Beistin where someone gave a car to the mechanic. The mechanic did some work on it. Then when the customer got it back, the engine failed. He had done some serious work on the engine. He had replaced parts, he had rebuilt something, and then the engine wouldn't work. So both sides were suing each other. The mechanic was suing for payment for the work he did. The customer was suing for damage to the car. So the work was clearly done. The work was, there was no debate. It was documented. It was easily able to be verified. The question was, we didn't know if the mechanic had done something negligent to the car, if he had messed something up, or if it was just one of those things that happens to cars. So the key question was, do we view those as two separate claims and say the work is an uncontested claim, you did the work, pay him for the work. Now go to a dentara about the damage, you can't prove it, and you can't prove he damaged your car and he'll walk away. Or do we say roll the claims together and say you claim that on balance, you owe me, I don't owe you, and I'm not going to pay him, it's an offer riot. So we spent a lot of time arguing about this, and it's a major complicated question. My feeling was, in general, that if it would be a separate claim, if you claim the mechanic had thrown a baseball into your window or something, those claims very likely would have to be judged separately. The mechanic's claim against me for the work I did, my claim against him for the baseball in my window, then there are many posts who say you view them as separate claims. But in a case where the damage is to the property that he says he deserves money for working on, I think there's a good argument to be made that we do roll that together and we do treat them as one. Which is right, which is part of the issue with how to understand your emotion. But that is a very important point. That is a good point. So one or two last points there. There's a brief passage of Rav Sadia Gaon that they've dug up. Rav Sadia brings the psukim of this Gemara, L'man telech b'derech tovim baruch ha-tzadikim tishmar, and he acknowledges that they mean l'fim ishur ha-din. Rav Sadia then says, this is something which is a person's personal obligation. Beistin's rulings have to be based on din and should not be taking this into account. Doesn't really get into the Gemara, but he says that the Fim Ishur's din is my business between me and my God, and it's not something Beistin should be paskening. There are two ways, however, to understand this Rav Sadia. The simple reading, which is adopted by Dr. Michal Vigoda, he's a Mishpat Ivri scholar, he has an excellent paper on the Fim Ishur's din. He takes for granted that Rav Sadia is simply taking sides on the machlokas we've been discussing, that he disagrees with the shitas that say you're kofel l'fim ishur ha-din. He says, we're not kofel l'fim ishur ha-din. He makes it a machlokas, what he calls sfardim and ashkenazim. The opinions we quote on Monday, we say we are kofel, we're generally some of the Balei Tosfos, the Aguda, the Rav Yah, the Ravan. Different shitas among the Chachmei Ashkenaz, the Balei Tosfos, they said you could be kofel. Rav Sadia is coming to dispute that. Rav Sadia is saying we're not kofel. That it's my personal obligation, it's not in Beistin's jurisdiction to enforce the Fim Ishur HaSadin. I saw a different explanation of Rav Sadia, though. This is maybe not as straightforward a reading, but it's also a plausible reading, I think. In the Sefer Halacha Brura, Halacha Psuka, an excellent anthology and commentary on Hilchos Dayanim, they take for granted, the editors there, that what Rav Sadia meant was, Beistin certainly can be kofa. Beistin can be kofa on mitzvahs. Beistin, if I don't want to put on tefillin, Beistin can be kofa me to put on tefillin. And Beistin can certainly be kofa me to do my mitzvah with the Mishur Sadin the same way they can be kofa me to do any other mitzvah. What the Sadia means is that when Beistin is acting in their capacity as dayanim, issuing a verdict, the verdict has to be clean. The verdict has to say, this is din, anything else is not din. But after they hand down the verdict, and the verdict says it's not din, if it's the Mishur Sadin, they can put on their other hat, so to speak. They can act in their capacity as the leaders of the community and force me to do my mitzvah with the Mishur HaZadin, just like they can force me to put on tefillin, as long as they make it clear that the din, the civil judgment they're handing down, does not include this. Now they can still make me do it possibly as a mitzvah. So practically speaking, it's going to boil down to the same thing, the end result. But all Rav Sadia means is that they have to very clearly delineate what they're doing as din and what they're doing as a form of kafir nala mitzvahs.